Okay, the Torah, we're
starting at the beginning. Because we've just had Simchat Torah, where we celebrate reading the entire cycle of the Torah once a week, one portion a week, we finish it, and then we start again at Genesis. And actually, we read Genesis last Saturday, last Shabbat, where I parashat Noach, but what we want to do today is to really cover both, talk about both the first two sections, and we'll see why, because really they form one entity. And before we do, so what is the Torah? The Torah is the five books of Moses, as it's usually called, usually referred to. And the Torah is really our guidebook for life. We could start out talking about Genesis and the age of the universe, and is it 5,777 years, or is it 15 billion years, and how do we reconcile that? And there's lots of interesting things to say about it, but we're not going to do all that right now. Because what I'd like to focus on is really, the Torah has some science, and it has some history, and it has a lot of things in it. But really, the main message that the Torah is here to give us is a message of how to relate to God, the Almighty, on three levels. Our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to the world, and our relationship to God. And that's what we're going to try and tease out of it. And that's really what the Torah is. It's really our spiritual guidebook for life, for how to relate to the Almighty. So in order to do that, I want to focus on some specific sections of Bereshit, of Genesis. Okay? And as you can see here, in the first beginning of Genesis, there are going to be four stories we're going to focus on. Okay, man's inner struggle, which will be the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and the tree, the fruit of the good of knowledge of good and evil. God's relationship to others, man's relationship to others, which is going to be the story of Cain and Abel, two brothers who fight. The story about the nature of society, which is going to be about the flood. And the story of man and society's relationship to God, which will be the story of the Tower of Babylon. You heard of all these stories? No. Okay. So we're also going to talk about, we're going to look at some passages. So we're going to do it in two ways. We're going to actually look at some specific passages. So we'll read text, because part of Torah study, a major part of Torah study, is engagement with the text. Learning how to look at it, how to analyze it, how to read it. And Jews were always asking questions. And then we're going to talk about some of the larger themes. Okay, and reading the text will be a springboard to allow us to read the larger themes. So, in order to understand man, and really that's what the beginning of Genesis is presenting us, before we get to Abraham, the first Jew, which is going to be next week, the Torah is really talking to us about what is the nature of man. Okay, so there we're going to look at creation and look at two sections on the creation of man. So let's look first, and I gave you my notes here, so you'll be able to go back and look back at things if you want. So, Genesis 1:27, which is, so this book is a little difficult to read because it doesn't give you the chapter. If you look at the footnotes below, you'll see the chapter. Oh, okay. So, 1:27 is on page 5. So who wants to read 1:27? Lauren, go ahead.
So God said, "Let us make man with our image and likeness. Let him dominate the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock animals, and all the earth, and every land animal that walks the earth." God thus created man with his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them.
So what does it mean that God, man was created in the image of God?
That's a question I have, because that's what I always hear, and I don't.
It's a very good question, because what is a fundamental idea in Judaism? God has no image.
Okay.
God cannot be a person, an idol, the sun. He has no. God is abstract. So how can you have an image of God? It's paradoxical. God says to Moses, "No man can see me and live, and I have no image." Right? That's one of the things Moses tells the people, that God has no image. So it must mean something deeper. And the first step to Torah study is that we look deeper for deeper meanings. So assuming it's not a physical image, what could it mean spiritually? On a deeper level. Any ideas?
Your inner self?
Okay.
World?
Something about your internal self is similar to God, and what would that be?
The good things.
Okay, and what do we call that? You're right on target. You're right on target.
It's not, I don't know.
Well, so let's look at the next text, which is Genesis 2:7. So flip ahead to page 8. And you, Anna, please read for me.
Okay.
2:7, page 8, the next page.
Okay.
You see chapter 2 there on the left, that little 2.
Heaven and earth, or do I start? God formed men out of dust of the ground.
That's it.
Okay. God formed men out of dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Men thus became a living creature. God planted it.
Okay, that's it. Okay. So God formed men from the dust of the ground and breathed into him the breath of life. So we're told that man has two dimensions. One is a physical body, but the other one is the breath of God. Now the word for breath is neshima, which is the same word as neshama, the soul. So what is God breathing into man? More than just a life force, which is the nefesh, which was also, man became a living creature. We have a life force, but even more than that, every animal has a life force. But man has the breath of God, which no other being has. And that's what we call a divine soul. What is a divine soul? So that we'll have to investigate further. But the goodness in man, the higher part, the higher self. And we're going to see how that will play itself out. Okay? So, but the Torah is setting down several things about man's nature. Man is created in the image of God. One understanding that image God might mean that we have a divine aspect of the divine within us. Now, the imagery of blowing is very interesting, because when you think about it, the breath that you blow out, it's not really a part of you, right? But yet, it's been within you. It's very close to you. So they use the imagery of the glass blower, right? The glass blower uses his breath to form the vessel, but the breath is not really part of him. The glass is not really part of him. So that's the analogy. The physical body is like the glass. God blowing into it to help form man. So it comes from within the divine, but it's not God himself. Okay. So we established that man has a higher self. According to some, the image of God will be man's ability to choose between good and evil. And we'll see why in a second. Because the next part of the story with the of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The sin of Adam and Eve, we ever heard of that? Yeah, right? Okay. So that's the next one. This is 1b, which is Genesis 2:15 to 17. They're going to be... Just like here, there were two things that tell us about how God created man. There are going to be two things now that will tell us about Adam and Eve in the garden. So 2:15 to 17. That's page 9. So I'm going to read. All right? God took the man and placed him in the garden of Eden to work it and watch it. God gave man a commandment saying, you can definitely eat from the every tree of the garden, but the tree of knowledge of good and evil do not eat, for on the day you eat from it, you will definitely die. Okay, so several things. God took man and placed him in the Garden of Eden. So when we learn, when we study the text, we're very careful about each word. And we ask ourselves, why did God say it this way and not that way? If it's saying it, we believe every word is put in the Torah for a thought-out, specific reason. We believe the Almighty gave this text to Moshe and gave it in a very specific way for us to be able to tease out meaning. Now the rabbis in the Midrash kind of give you some of these explanations. Why wouldn't the Torah just have all the explanations written out? Why make it cryptic, difficult to be accessed? Any ideas?
Torah is not just the book, it's also the effort of understanding it and relating to it, and that makes it timeless.
So it gives us the satisfaction of working on it and drawing out those meanings. It also allows for a variety of meaning depending upon people in different periods, right?
But in Mesilat Yesharim, I think the Ramchal actually wrote that the full Torah isn't even written down.
Right, there are meanings and meanings and meanings, correct. But another aspect of it is that it teaches us to look deeper. And that's like life, right? In life too, what you see is not always what you get. People are more than just your first impression. So the act of unpacking, looking carefully, examining, analyzing, teaches us a skill which we can use in our lives in general to look for the deeper meaning. Mm. So God took man and placed him in the Garden of Eden. What's striking about that? Well, we're going to know that he doesn't last long in the Garden of Eden, right? And, you know, we kind of feel like, well, I wish I could just be in the Garden of Eden, right? Everything, I got to get up, I got to work, I got to, you know, it would be nice if life was just daiquiris by the pool, right? So, where are we really meant to be? It's not clear. Maybe Adam and Eve didn't last long in the garden, because where were they created in the garden?
It seems not.
No, right?
They were at all, because they were placed there.
Yeah.
They were placed there.
So maybe that's not really our environment. But then we're going to have to ask, why were they placed there? In an environment which wasn't where they were created, and which they're going to have difficulty staying in. Okay. All interesting questions.
So why?
Well,
okay.
We need more information so we can unpack it. Okay. The questions are always better than the answers anyway.
Okay.
So in the Garden of Eden, to work it and to watch it. Now, to work it, the commentators all, there are many, many commentators, and they all, what does this mean? So, because later Adam's going to be told, you're going to have to now work hard to make your bread. So most of them say that this is not physical work. The fruit just grew, Adam and Eve didn't have to do physical work, this is spiritual working it and watching it. They were able to spend all their time serving the Almighty, in prayer and meditation, in fixing, in making God's world more beautiful, but they didn't really have to work. God gave man a commandment. Okay, so he gave him a commandment. You can definitely eat from every tree of the garden. And by the way, this is good pedagogical instructions. You don't tell your kid, you're not allowed to do that. Because you tell them, you can play with this, or you can do that, or you can have fun with this. But, you know, stay off your iPod right now, please. Right? But what do we know about human nature? What happens when you say, don't go in that door?
People go there.
Well, the first thing you want to do is go in the door, right? Okay. Which is leads us to the same question, like, is God setting them up? Like, you know, why create a tree and then tell them you're not allowed to have it? Okay?
Yeah, couldn't God have easily placed Adam and Eve in a garden without this tree?
Right. Okay. From the God tree of the knowledge of good and evil, do not eat. For on the day you eat from it, you will definitely die. Okay. So before we kind of try to understand why would God not want them to have the knowledge of good and evil, let's continue the story because we don't have enough information yet. Okay?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, you can always ask questions.
Why does he say you will definitely die? What does that mean?
So that we have to understand as well, because they're going to eat from it and they're not going to die right away. But God will tell them, you are now mortal. You would have been immortal had you not eaten from it.
So does that mean, what does that mean?
It means that before they ate from it, they would have lived forever.
So does that mean that when people on earth die, then that's it? There's nothing else?
No, we believe that the soul lives on. But in your physical life, you're going to die.
Right. But so what I'm trying to say is that, does this mean that there is no internal life in that sentence?
No, it means your physical body will die.
Or just the physical.
And you would have lived on physically and spiritually, but once you eat from this, you would now become mortal. Your bodies would die.
Okay, but the soul continues.
Right. Yeah. So, look at now Genesis 3:1, chapter 3, where the story continues. Okay, you want to read?
Sure.
Gedalia.
The serpent was the most cunning of all the wild beasts. Is that where we are?
Mm-hmm.
The serpent was the most cunning of all the wild beasts that God had made. The serpent asked the woman, "Did God really say that you may not eat from any of the trees of the garden?"
We're going to read the whole paragraph, and then we're going to come back.
The woman replied to the serpent, "We may eat from the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree which that is in the middle of the garden, God said, do not eat it, and do not even touch it, or else you will die." The serpent said to the woman, you will certainly not die. Really, God knows that on the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat and desirable to the eyes.
Okay. Yeah, keep going.
And that the tree was attractive as a means to gain intelligence. She took some of its fruit and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, and he ate it. The eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. They sewed together fig leaves and made themselves loincloths.
Okay, let's break here. So we've got two parts. We've got this back and forth with the serpent, and then she finally decides, this is good stuff, I'm going to eat it. Okay? So she goes against God's commandment. And then she gave it to her husband, and something happened to them. Right? They were transformed. They had this knowledge of good and evil. Okay. So, first of all, the interaction with the snake. So, this is very difficult to understand, because today snakes don't speak. I'm not going to try to address that so directly, but let's tease out from it once again, what are the lessons we're supposed to learn from this, right? The rabbis tell us the snake is really the lower voice. And we saw before, man is created from his physical body and is given a divine soul. So the snake represents the voice of the body, the voice of the lower drives, right? And so there's this back and forth. "Are you really not allowed to eat it?" said, well, so look at what he did. He's very cunning, right? He said, "You're not allowed to eat anything?" And she says, no, we're allowed. We're allowed to eat anything, but just this one thing we can't eat. Right? He's already making her think like, oh, if I can eat everything, why can't I eat this? Right? And then God said, now think about when we rationalize things like, oh, it's not so bad, or why can't I just do this, or, right? So she says, God said, don't eat it, don't even touch it, or you will die. Right? So that one we're not allowed to. Serpent said, you won't die. Really, God knows on the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. This is interesting. So what could be creating the image of God? It could be, he said, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. So maybe that's what it means, we are creating the image of God. Think about it. No other animal. You know, if a lion kills someone, is a bad lion?
It doesn't work.
No, it's a hungry lion. It has no moral choice, dilemma, conscience. And it doesn't need to, and it's not supposed to. The human being is the only animal who has that level of choosing. So he's telling her, God doesn't want you to eat this because you're going to be more like God. You're going to have this higher level of knowledge. Right? Is that true? Probably not. That's not why God isn't jealous. Right? But it is true that when, if they eat it, then they will have internalized this knowledge of good and evil. Now, what does that mean? Okay? What does that mean? Having the knowledge of good and evil. Didn't they have the knowledge of good and evil before? They knew, don't eat it, that's bad. Following God's commandment is good. Going against it is bad. So it seems like they had some level of knowledge of good and evil. Right?
Mm.
So this is the way Maimonides explains it. So, and if they didn't have knowledge of good and evil before, how could they do evil and go against God's commandment? Right? It's kind of a catch-22. Either they had some ability to choose evil and go against God's command, or if they didn't, how could they ever go against it? So Maimonides says this, and this is how, and this is what I think one of the lessons is here, is that there are certain choices that we could make. Like, a person could choose, if you live on the 10th floor, to open up the window and jump out. Right? You could choose to do it. But if you are mentally stable, you have no desire to. And you're not going to. Because you know it's self-destructive. So Maimonides calls that true and false. You know it's a false thing to do because it's self-destructive and it's totally wrong. But, you know, if I know that there's this thing on my 1099 that really the government would never know, and I'm working and I'm getting cash and they're never going to know whether I got this money or not, and, you know, so there I'm in more of a struggle, right? Oh, no one's going to get hurt, no one will know it, doesn't matter, right? So that's the moral struggle. So for Adam and Eve, it was clear that they shouldn't eat from the fruit, but they could have chosen to do so. So some things in our lives are very clear, like, you know, if I get mad at someone, most people, they're not going to like think of, I'm going to pick up this hammer and crack their head open. Even if you feel like doing it, you're not going to do it. Because, you know, it's just false. It's just clear that, and I have no desire to really do it. I can control myself. But, so that's the way they lived their whole lives. There was nothing drawing them to go against God's will. After they ate from the fruit, the good and evil was internalized, and some things that they wanted but knew they shouldn't have, there was this dry urge to do it anyway. And that's the knowledge of good and evil. It means the experience of good and evil. They might have had the knowledge before, but it wasn't a struggle for them. It was an objective thing. Now, if that's the case, how did they ever make the mistake?
Maybe because they were designed that way. They were curious, like they... It says, the woman saw that the tree was attractive as a means to gain intelligence.
Oh, so this
what do they want? It's like they had everything provided for them, but right. It seems like they wanted wisdom.
Right, so this is the way Maimonides explains it. He says, they felt this, they made this calculation. If we're serving God, but it's easy. If we eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and we know what that means, and even despite that, we still choose to listen to God, won't that be such a greater way to serve Him? Right?
Hmm.
Kind of like, you know, the lover who says, I'm going to go in a barrel and go over the Niagara Falls to prove my love to you. Right? Kind of not
people,
needed.
People have done that.
Not needed.
Many people.
Yeah. So, not needed, but people do it. So that was their calculation. And there's another deep message in there, is that people think, you know, if I'm tested and I come out, I'll be even stronger. But you should never ask for a test.
That's famous, terrible.
Famous story, sorry?
That's terrible, asking for a test.
Right, said, try it, you know. King David, they say, asked God to, said, test me. And he went out on his balcony in his palace, and two buildings over on the roof of the building of a house, there was this most beautiful woman ever bathing herself, and he immediately fell love-struck for her. She happened to be married, and it was a big mess. So don't look for more trouble than you have already. Usually life has enough tests. Don't look for more. Okay? So that's the idea of she's saying we could have the knowledge, right? So let's look what happens after. Verse 8. Go ahead.
They heard God's voice moving about in the garden with the wind of the day. The man and his wife hid themselves from God among the trees of the garden. God called to the man, and he said, "Where are you trying to hide?" "I heard your voice in the garden," replied the man, "and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." God asked, "Who told you that you were naked? Did you eat from the tree which I commanded you not to eat?" The man replied, "The woman that you gave to be with me, she gave me what I ate from the tree." God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman replied, "The serpent seduced me and I ate it."
Okay, so two parts here. So the first is, you know, they heard God's voice moving about. What does that mean? They became aware of God. And what did they do? They hid. Why?
Because they knew they did something.
And what's that called? What's that emotion called?
Guilt.
Guilt, embarrassment, shame. More embarrassment and shame. Judaism, we don't believe in guilt. I'll tell you why in a second.
Really?
Okay. Okay. Embarrassment and shame. God called to man and said, "Where are you?" What's the glaring question here? Is this a game of hide and go seek with God? Does God know where they are?
Yes.
So why did he ask him, "Where are you?" What do you have got, you know, the angry parent comes out and sees that, you know, George Washington cut down the cherry tree, and what do you expect them to say? "How dare you do that," right? That's what they expected. But what did God do?
He was like, "Where are you?" Why? The conversation.
Exactly. He started the conversation. He gave Adam and Eve an opportunity to
explain
and
speak.
Well, not really explain, it's not my explanation. They just wanted it and did it anyway. But what should they be doing?
Saying sorry.
Come clean and apologize.
Yeah.
"Actually, God, remember that tree you told me about, right? Well, it didn't go so well, and I feel really bad." You know, like, you know, you first get your driver's license, and you take the car out, and, you know, you bash it up. Are you just going to, like, park it in the driveway and then go run off to your friend's house? And your parents come and say, "What happened?" Nothing happened. No, you come and you say, "Guess what, guys," right?
Yes.
But is that what they did?
No.
No. And listen to the way that God said it. "Where are you?" That could be a physical question of, you know, he's hiding, where are you? But what else could it be?
Spiritual question?
Where are you?
Yeah.
Where are you? Where are you? Right? So, you see the double meaning, right? Each word. Okay, so what does he answer him?
"You're hiding."
"I was afraid because I was naked." So he said, you know, well, you know, like. So God gives him another question to kind of, well, "Who told you were naked?"
And this is very funny.
And then he says, "Did you eat from the tree?" Right? Once again, not bowling him out. "That I told you not to eat." It's a leading question, again, giving the opportunity again to apologize.
Yes.
Now, but they were naked before, but what's shifted?
They figured out that they were naked.
Well, they became self-conscious about the fact. Why? Because before, physicality, there was no driving them to desire sexual stimulation just for its own sake. It was an act that would have brought them closer together, that would have brought them children, that would have been a higher act. But now they knew they had the potential to use it as a lower act, so they have to start putting it under wraps and controlling it, and right? They have that self-awareness. Did you eat from the tree? He gives them another opportunity to come free, and what does he say? The man said, now this is the real loser. What does he say?
He said that
it's her fault and it's your fault.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't have stuck her in my life, it wouldn't have happened, and it's her fault. What do we call that?
Shifting the blame.
Victim mentality, which often then projects blame upon the other, right? This is a lesson in
not being responsible.
How not to act, right? Right? But our first impulse is to do all these things. And if we do them, then after we realize, like, that was the stupidest thing to do, right?
So are we self-conscious in our daily life because of certain things, because that's a lower instinct, or why are we self-conscious?
You mean about our nakedness or our physicality?
No, about things that we may be self-conscious in life in general.
It depends. I mean, sometimes self-consciousness could be, oh, I shouldn't get defensive, I did something wrong, I should fess up. That self-consciousness is higher. Overcoming our first impulse to flee, avoid, rationalize, shift the blame.
Mm-hmm.
That self-consciousness can be good. Self-consciousness can be a good tool in front of other people to regulate our behavior, right? But sometimes if we're too self-conscious, we behave according to what we think other people are expecting of us and not what we really want to do. And that could turn bad. So, you know, I think it can be many different things, right?
Okay.
But self-awareness is thinking about, how am I reacting? Is that the proper reaction? You know, so emotionally I might want to shift the blame or avoid, but if I really think about it, I'm like, if I want to save this relationship, I should just come clean, apologize, and maybe I can salvage something. But in order to do it, you have to eat some humble pie, right? So that's the Torah's telling us, we're supposed to go against our first reactions, which are our lower selves, which is avoid, shift blame, don't take responsibility, right? God said to her, what did you do? And what did she say?
She said, the serpent made me do it.
He did it! Same thing. Okay. So we're not going to do the curses here, because I do want to move on to some of the other stories. But what we see is man being created with image of God, a higher soul, and we see a story where they're in struggle between their lower selves, that just wants to eat the thing, even though they're not supposed to, and their higher selves, which knows they shouldn't. They lose the battle. Right? And then we see a struggle in how they react to it afterwards, and they seem to have kind of lost the battle too. Okay? Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden, and, you know, some of the questions we asked before, well, you know, why did God put them in there and then tell them not to, and then create this tree and tell them not to do it, and then they do it and they get kicked out? So this question is a very deep, difficult question. One way you might approach it is to say that God knew we were going to mess up, right? And God knew that Adam and Eve were going to be in the state where the struggle of good and evil is within them, not a snake external to them. But we're supposed to be in that state. Why? Because when we struggle and overcome our negatives, our lower self, we play a role in becoming more divine. And that is a godly quality. In other words, if God would just make us like spiritual automatons, so what? But when God creates us, now Judaism doesn't believe in original sin. Now we're all damned and we're all sinners and we have to be redeemed. That's the Christian take on this story. We believe that we are in a state, and that's why Christian guilt is, yeah, you do a sin, you are now guilty, meaning your essence is tainted. There's something intrinsically wrong with you and bad about you. Judaism doesn't view it that way. Judaism views, and I don't use the word sin, I use the word transgression, which means you messed up. You crossed a line you shouldn't have. So we believe that we are not, we believe in original sin because their nature was changed, but now they're in a state of struggle. And man is in a state of struggle, and this story teaches us man's going to mess up. That's human nature, is to make mistakes. So what do you do afterwards? Well, we know what not to do. Don't shift blame. Now, what to do, God will tell Cain and Abel some of what you can do. Okay? So those are some of the messages, I think, that this story is teaching us. Any questions? So to answer the question, so why did God then create them, put them in, have them fall out? Because at least he gave us a taste of what it is like to be in the Garden of Eden. To be what it's like when you overcome, let's say you have a bad habit, you know, you get angry, and you struggle with it. The goal is to go cold turkey, and once you learn to let go of that anger, then it's no longer so much of a struggle, right? You've gotten to the point where, okay, I don't lose my cool every time someone ticks me off. And it's not so hard anymore. It goes from being struggle of good and evil to just external knowledge of that it's wrong. It's no longer has a grip on me. So the goal is to take those struggles and to overcome them.
So in Judaism, we believe that it's normal to mess up, but if you mess up, then you have to do something.
Right, and we'll see what that is. That's the whole process of tshuva, of taking ownership over it, apologizing for it, trying to change it.
And then getting to a higher spiritual level.
Yeah. Okay. Cain and Abel. Fascinating. Another fascinating story. So,
page 17.
Yeah, next page.
You're probably there.
Yeah.
So look at verse 3. Whose turn? My turn. An era ended. Cain brought some of his crops. So Adam and Eve have these two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain was a farmer, and Abel was a shepherd. So Cain brought some of his crops as an offering to God. He had this idea, you know what? I'm going to serve God. I'm going to give God. I worked hard. I planted. I watered. I waited the whole season. I harvested. I have all these crops. And I'm going to give some of it back to God as an offering. Because I realize God has played a part in giving me my abundance. Abel also offered some of the firstborn of his flock from the fattest ones. God paid heed to Abel and his offering, but to Cain and his offering he paid no heed. Cain became very furious and depressed. God said to Cain, "Why are you so furious? Why are you depressed? If you do good, will there not be special privilege? But if you do not do good, sin is crouching at the door. It lusts after you, but you can dominate it." Cain said something to his brother Abel. Then, when they happened to be in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. God asked Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I do not know," replied Cain. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Okay, what happened? Cain brings his fruit. God ignores it. His brother Abel sees him, what he did, brings his thing, and God takes it. Why? So if you notice, it says Abel brought his firstborn. Cain brought some of his stuff. So the rabbis say that Cain brought the best of his. Cain brought not the best. Kind of stuff which, I don't really want this stuff anyway. But I'll offer it to God. Abel brought his most beautiful animal. And so God took it. So imagine, you are Cain. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? More feeling than thinking. What are you feeling? Do you have siblings?
No, I'm a child.
Only child. Okay. Best friend.
Yeah.
It was resentful. Resentful. What else is that called?
Envy.
Envy. Jealous. Resentful. Not fair. Not fair. Not fair.
I feel like you did something wrong, maybe?
Not necessarily. Well, maybe you should. But he didn't. What did he do?
He killed his brother.
He's angry. He's angry at his brother. Right?
Yes.
Well, first, he becomes very angry.
And then he's depressed. Right? And by some people say, you know, anger and depression are sometimes two sides of a coin. So God said to him, why are you furious? Why are you depressed? If you do good, you can lift yourself up, literally. In other words, you have a choice. You can take the high road, and you will be elevated. If you do not, now look how this expresses it. Sin is crouching at the door. It lusts after you. Once again, still semi-external. So he's saying, realize that this isn't you. This is your lower voice trying to grab a hold of you. This is the snake. It's not you. But you can dominate it. And this is the fundamental concept of free will. Right? Adam and Eve could messed up, but God's saying here, no, man can choose, cannot mess up, can choose the higher road. Even though you feel like it's just totally overtaken. But you have a choice. And by the way, we believe this in general society, otherwise we wouldn't hold people accountable, right? People, you know, they hit someone or they kill someone, we drag them into court and we prosecute them. Why? Because we believe you're responsible because you could have chosen not to do this. Right? Even crimes of passion. Well, he was, you know, with my girlfriend. It's not an excuse for... Okay. So, does Cain listen to this? So what should Cain's reactions have been? What would be to take the high road? What would you do if you were Cain?
Bring some better stuff.
Right? Do the same thing. He stole my idea and God paid attention to him first. Okay, but have a little humility and say, you know what? He did it better than me. He added to it. I could have come up with that from the beginning. I didn't. So, maybe I didn't deserve to have mine taken first. But there's still a time. If I'm just here to serve God, it doesn't matter. Mine was first, his was second. Just bring it.
Yeah, you could have... Yeah, could have made it into like a friendly competition.
Or not at all. He could have just said, okay, I'm going to go do my thing.
Yeah.
Right? Cain said something to his brother Abel, we don't know what their conversation was. There are many different takes on this. I won't get into it now. And then they were out in the field. Cain rose up against his brother and killed him. God asked Cain, where is your brother Abel? Now, should he have been mad at his brother? No, he really should have been mad at God. But the jealousy was towards his brother. He wanted what his brother had, which was God's favor. I do not know, replied Cain. Am I my brother's keeper? What's he doing again?
Shifting the blame.
It's a different type of, he's saying, you know, I'm not accountable for him. Is he saying, well, he should have watched his back? Or is he just kind of trying to pull a fast one on God? Like, I don't know where he is, and it's not my job to keep track of him. It's not clear. Right? Generally, the interpretation is the second one. Like, not my job to keep track of him. But it's a different... So this is... So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks very interestingly says, Adam and Eve threw off personal accountability, right? Personal responsibility. He threw off moral accountability for the other. Like, I'm not my brother's keeper, and not only that, and if he gets me mad, I'm going to kill him, right? That's rejection of moral responsibility towards the other. So that's the second story of Cain and Abel. The third story is the beginning of this week's Parsha. Shift ahead to page 27. And look at 27:11. Gedalia, go ahead and read.
The world was corrupt before God, and the land was filled with crime. God saw the world, and it was corrupted. All flesh had perverted its way on the earth.
So it's very interesting. So the Hebrew here, and by the way, and it's a good thing you want to learn Hebrew, because there are subtleties to the language and to things that will be expressed in the Torah that the translation cannot capture, or the translation only captures one dimension of it. But
there's also numbering in this.
That's too very good. So it says the land was now tishaches, corrupt before God, and the land was full of chamas. Yeah, that's the word, chamas. That's it. Yep. So the commentaries say, what is tishaches? That there was sexual immorality and idolatry. And the Hamas, what was the Hamas?
Violent crime?
No, stealing, lack of justice.
Lack of justice.
So which is worse? Depravity or dishonesty?
Dishonesty?
We have an election in front of us, folks. Which is worse, depravity or dishonesty? Good luck deciding, right?
It's really the worst election ever.
This is this week's Parsha. This is it. It's right here. The world was full. These are our leaders. And by the way, in the previous page, if you turn back, page 6. So if you look, chapter 6, verse 2. The sons of God saw the daughters of men. Now, one opinion is, it's not the sons of God. The sons of the leaders saw the daughters of men were good, and they took for themselves whoever they choose. Mm. The leaders were just grabbing whatever women they wanted. It's right here.
Oh, wow. That's unbelievable.
It's right here. It's right here. This week's Parsha of the election. And it says the world was full of Tishaches, it was perverted. And then it was full of Hamas, it was dishonesty, stealing, lying.
Injustice.
Lying, injustice. It's right here.
Perversion of justice.
It's right here. This is wild. I mean, I just, you know, think about this, but even the thing before about the leaders just grabbing whoever they wanted.
What's next week's question?
Uh-oh. More hope. Hope. Next week is the turnaround, the hope.
Oh, really?
But, okay. I mean, you see, this is scary. This is who our role model, this is who we're choosing to lead us. And what happened to the world? God said, this world doesn't justify its existence if this is what man is doing. Why? Because what did we see? Why was man created? Man was created from the dust of the earth, but God breathed into him a divine soul. And then God said, don't internalize the evil. And then when Cain and Abel acted upon it, he said, you can hold back the ability. So there are two more verses. Look here in number 3. 3b. So after the world, God destroys the world with the flood, what does it say? Never again will I curse the soul of man. The soul of man. For the inclination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Yeah. It's 8:21, but I reprinted it for you. Do you see there?
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
3b. Mm-hmm. What is that saying? Do we believe in original sin? It looks like original sin. So, Rabbi Hirsch points out the inclination of man's heart. In other words, Yetzer Machshavot Ish. The Yetzer Levish, the drive of his heart. In other words, he has this drive, which can be bad, from his youth. When children are born, what are young kids?
Mischievous,
but also they just want, right? They're all about themselves.
They're takers.
And they're takers. Okay? And if they don't evolve, what happens? Some people never grow up, and they spend the rest of their lives being like that. So God's saying, I know man has that, and maybe sometimes they don't evolve. But before the flood, in 6:5 it said, God saw that man's wickedness on earth was increasing. Every impulse of his innermost thought was only for evil. In other words, the impulse of his thoughts, once again, the same idea, the thoughts that he allows to come into his heart. First it's a thought, then it's emotional, then what happens? We act upon it. Hmm. So the Torah very much believes to try and keep our thoughts away from negative things.
That's what Rabbi Manus Friedman says.
It's right there.
I was like, oh, that's where he got it.
The Torah says it. We all got it from the Torah. So that's what it's saying, is that man has the ability to, but it's hard for him. But when this whole society acted on it, God said, man is not fulfilling the purpose on which he was placed here. So his existence no longer justifies itself. So he destroys that generation. He starts again with Noah, who was the righteous man.
So he destroyed these people?
Yeah, the flood came and everyone was wiped out. And he started over with Noah. Kind of a new Adam. Because everything else had been tainted. He says, let's try again. But then afterwards he realizes, but you know what, man is an imperfect being, so I won't take an extreme, wipe everyone else off the earth again. And we're going to have to see what are the other options.
It's interesting that there's a lot of this in our mass media, like the film and TV these days. The zombie movies are like, the zombies take whatever they want. You know, they want brains. They run after you to get your brains. And the people, the survivors, are able to do the same because it's like, whatever they want, they just break into the grocery store and take everything. Right? Or all these disaster movies where it's the same idea.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost like you're saying that, you know, if everything, the world can become bad again, and then there'll be another.
Well, we'll have to see. What are the other options?
Probably not.
There's one more story that I wanted to share with you quickly in the last couple of minutes. And that's at the end of the Parsha of Noah. And that's the story of the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babylon.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
So when, I don't know if this is true, but sometimes people say that if bad things happen to you, God will avenge the stuff that happened to you. Is this true?
So, we believe that, yes, we hope, we believe that ultimately God does bring justice.
So is this like kind of where it comes from, this story?
Well, many people, all over in the Torah, it says, you know, a person acts in the right path, they'll goodness will come to them. If they do bad, eventually it'll catch up with them, or God will punish them for it. Yeah? So let's look at the last story here. And we are here on page 49. The entire earth had one language and uniform words. When the people migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. They said to one another, "Let us build bricks and fire them." They had bricks to use as stone and asphalt for mortar. They said, "Let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top shall reach the sky. Let's make for ourselves a name so that we will not be scattered over all the face of the earth." In other words, we want fame, we want big, we want to show. We want to build the tallest building in the world, right? God descended to see the city and the tower that the sons of man had built. In other words, why had they built this? What were their intentions? Was it to make their lives better, or was there something else, like to make a name for ourselves? Was it ego, or was it helping? God said, "They are single people, all having one language." So this is good. They're all getting together. They're pooling their talents. They're collaborating. Collaborative team, right? All the buzzwords, all the right buzzwords in the corporate world today, right? And this is the first thing they do. Now, when it said before, whose tower... Now, it's not clear what was so bad about what they did. Now nothing they plan to do will be unattainable for them. So what was so bad? So the rabbis say, when it said earlier in verse 4, that its top will reach the sky, literally in the Hebrew it says, will be in the heavens. Its top will reach the heavens. So the rabbis say, what were they doing? They wanted to reach the heavens to substitute God. They're saying, we can be up there in the heavens like God, and we don't need God. So when man had the ability to create, they felt like, we don't need a creator, we can create. Right? Ego, power, a name. And it's subtleties, like it's not obvious in the text, like what's so bad. But small subtleties. Let's do it because we want to make a name. Not because we want to help everyone. Let's make it to the heavens. Not let's make it, you know, solid. So the rabbis say that they're trying to push God out. And that's what happens. When man becomes too... And as we said, now they could do anything. When man has too much ability, what do? We start to... It gets to our heads. And we think we don't need God. We don't need anything else. We need, you know, education, culture, technology. We can save everything. Until you get to the 20th century, the culture that had the most of all of this, and we see where it went without God. So, God, come, let us descend and confuse their speech so that one person will not understand another's speech. We're going to create discord so that people won't... Their egos won't get so big because they won't have ultimate power.
Who is he saying come to?
Good question. What does he say in the notes here? Us, God was speaking to the angels.
The angels.
Or to the forces of creation.
Okay.
Right? And then God had scattered them. So Rabbi Sacks, I mean, if you look at the beginning of Genesis, it's very puzzling. What is the stories, basically? It's one disaster after another. Right? Adam and Eve put in the garden, they got everything, don't touch this tree. That's exactly what they do. God gives them a chance to make up for it, they don't. Cain and Abel, the only two human beings in the world, one kills another, fratricide. And then you have an entire society that corrupts itself. Got to get rid of them. And then, when people are finally united, but then what do they try to do? push God out of the picture. So that's what Rabbi Sacks said. There's four levels of abdication of morality and responsibility, right? You have it on the other side there? You have personal responsibility, Adam and Eve, being told you can make your choices. Moral responsibility, am I my brother's teacher, right? How you act towards others. The third, the flood, is collective responsibility. Society is violent towards, on a whole societal level, not just the act of one person. And then, the Tower of Babylon, they're abdicating responsibility towards God. And trying to push God out of the picture. So it's one disaster after another. And if you look at it, it seems to be a very pessimistic outlook on human nature. So, stay tuned.
But
we'll have to see next week.
There's heroes in three of them. Right?
Okay, who are the heroes? Interesting, yeah. Well, Noah.
Adam and Noah.
Noah's the obvious hero.
Noah,
right? Is he a hero?
He's a tragic hero, I think. He did the right thing,
right.
And he died.
He did the right thing.
He was killed.
Okay. Right, so I mean...
Tower of Babel, though.
Well, no. So this is very interesting. Everyone asks, big question. In the Tower of Babel, they're rebelling against God. You'd think that's the worst thing you can do, and he would wipe them out. The generation of the flood, they weren't rebelling against God. They were stealing, cheating, immoral, fornicating, idolatry, and they were killed. They were wiped out. So why the difference? So what they say is that the Tower of Babel, they were united. They were working together. And for God, it's more important that men, if we get along with each other, God looks much more favorably upon us, even if we push him out of the picture sometimes, than if we are not treating other people right. So we believe that all human beings are children of God, and God cares more about his children than himself, right? Every parent cares more about, not every, but, you know, parents are meant, you know, the people who nurture their parental feelings care more about their children than themselves. They sacrifice for their children. That's certainly Jewish way. So people sacrifice for their children. So God, you know, you take me on, okay, I don't like it, but you start mistreating my children, now I'm really upset. Now I can't count this. So that's what they say. Hmm. Why? You know, and there was a heroic side to it, a positive side to it, which was at least they got along, they unified. So there are glimmers of hope, but overall it's a very pessimistic outlook on the world. And if you look out there, just turn on the evening news.
I mean, it's kind of true.
The world's a pretty messed up place.
I was thinking...
Wars, fighting, domestic
terrible.
Violence, child abuse. I mean, horrible, horrible. By the way, I do not watch the evening news. Do not watch television.
I don't watch TV.
It just shows you the worst of the worst. And unfortunately, it's all too prevalent, but we shouldn't think that that's all there is. Because we're going to see next week... there is better. And it starts with Abraham and Sarah. And that's what we're going to have to go see.
Okay.
And God, instead of saying, okay, he promised he wouldn't destroy the world, so he can't destroy it again. So instead of get rid of it, start over, he's got to have a new plan. And that new plan is going to be a rehab program. It's going to be rehab for the world. It's going to take a while. It's going to start with two people. And we're going to see what Rabbi Sacks shows incredibly, is that the stories that Abraham, each of Abraham's heroic actions will address each of these failings.
Mm.
Okay? Towards one's own internal self-discipline, towards one's brother, towards one's society, and towards God. So, stay tuned.
What? Does God still talk to us?
Not directly, not prophecy, like we see this. We believe prophecy ended 2,500 years ago.
2,500?
With the closing of the last book of the Jewish Bible, which was around the year 400 BCE, when the Jews went back from Babylon to Israel. Ezra and Nehemiah were like the last of the two. But we believe that some people still have divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, like a higher insight that comes to them. And we believe each and every one of us, because we have a divine soul, has an inner voice where we can get in touch with our higher self and with what does God want from me. So God doesn't speak to us audibly directly, but God speaks to us sometimes by giving us thoughts in our minds, by opening up our hearts, by trying to look in our own souls to feel what would God want. So, a little less direct.
What about the rabbis who are, you know, like in the yeshivas, like Rav Kanievsky? Does God speak to him?
So, that's what I'm saying. There are some people who, because they're so connected to their divine soul, they have perceptions that go beyond normal perceptions.
How do you get connected like that? You study the Torah?
Study the Torah, try to serve God, go on a spiritual path.
And I know that in Judaism it's very important to